And we're going to have a reading. God's word is going to be read to us. Children, listen out carefully as Chris Green, thank you, Chris, comes and reads the passage about Jesus' transfiguration when he transforms. Thanks very much, Chris.
It's Mark's Gospel, chapter 9, verse 2. It's page 1012 in the Church Bible. The Transfiguration. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say. They were so frightened. Then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my son, whom I love. Listen to him." Suddenly, when they looked around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus gave them orders not to tell anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. They kept the matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. And they asked him, "Why do the teachers of the Lord say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah does come first and restores all things. Why then is it written that the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? But I tell you, Elijah has come, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it is written about him."
Thanks, Chris. And Chris is going to come back in a bit and read the second part of the passage to us as well, keeping her busy this morning. Before we sing again and then look at the passage, we're going to have the second part of the passage. Thank you, Chris. She's going to come and read Mark chapter 9 from verse 14.
So it's Mark 9, verse 14, sorry. Jesus heals a boy possessed by an impure spirit. When they came to the other disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and the teachers of the Lord arguing with them. As soon as all the people saw Jesus, they were overwhelmed with wonder and ran to greet him. "What are you arguing with them about?" he asked. A man in the crowd answered, "Teacher, I brought you my son, who is possessed by a spirit that has robbed him of speech. Whenever it seizes him, it throws him to the ground. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not." "You unbelieving generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." So they brought him. When the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. He fell to the ground and rolled around, foaming at the mouth. Jesus asked the boy's father, "How long has he been like this?" "From childhood," he answered. "It has often thrown him into fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible for one who believes." Immediately the boy's father exclaimed, "I do believe. Help me overcome my unbelief." When Jesus saw that a crowd was running to the scene, he rebuked the impure spirit. "You deaf and mute spirit," he said, "I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." The spirit shrieked, convulsed him violently, and came out. The boy looked so much like a corpse that they said, "He's dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him to his feet, and he stood up.
Well done. There's quite a few things that connect quite a few of us, isn't there? Some of us are the same age. Some of us are the same gender. Some of us have similar hairstyles to each other. Some of us here are Christians. Some of us here are young. Some of us here are older. But there's one thing that connects all of us without fail. And that is that we all underestimate the glory of Jesus. No matter who we are, no matter what our education, no matter our age, learning, whether we're sitting here today not very interested in Jesus, whether we're kind of interested in him, whether we belong to him, whether we're preaching about him right now, all of us, we all do not get how supremely glorious Jesus is. Is that a problem? Does it matter if we don't get Jesus very well? Another thing we need to be united in is seeing what lostness is. We need to be sure what lostness is. And lostness is to see Jesus, but there be nothing about him that excites us. It's to be, hear the gospel about him, but actually to be bored by it, uninterested. It's to see the important and wonderful things as being perhaps our gadgets, our work, our family, our health, our holidays. They're good. There's lots of good things we're given. But they become far more wonderful than they ought if we don't see Jesus. We need revelation. We need revelation. Christianity is a fight to see, to understand, to grasp, to see that Jesus is far more glorious than we realize. That he is the gospel. That the light of the gospel is displayed in the glory of the face of Christ. That the glory of the Father is seen in the face of Christ. And we need to see the glory of Jesus. And the big question we keep hitting in this section of Mark's gospel is, do we get it? Do we get him? Do we get the plan? Do we get the call he makes on our lives? He is the Christ, Peter's just said. The plan, the bombshell comes, that he must suffer and die. And his call is that whoever would follow must deny themselves and take up their cross. So in a very short space of time, the disciples have gone from elation, like, yeah, he's God, to deflation. He's going to die. And so are we. So the question comes, how are they and us to make sense of this? How are they and how are us going to keep following Jesus? How are they and how are we going to bear our cross now? How are we going to live lives of self-denial that cost? Is Jesus really worth following? Well, we've heard last time that to lose our lives now for his sake is to save our lives. Wonderful words. But Peter later writes that there was something else that kept us going. He says there was a moment when we were with Jesus. There was something that happened that strengthened us. And he writes this in 2 Peter, he's writing to encourage Christians to persevere in their faith. And he says in 2 Peter 1 verse 16, we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came saying, this is my son whom I love, listen to him. We ourselves heard that voice, Peter says, when we were with him on the sacred mountain. So Peter, through Mark, points back to our passage today and says, that revelation of his majestic glory convinced us. It did something in us. as to who he was. That transformation we saw on the mountain transformed our faith, gave us hope, strength to keep going. In Cornwall, Crackington Haven to be precise, there's a lovely path going diagonally along the cliff. There it is. It's pretty steep and rocky, but on the path is a bench. There it is. It's about there. I couldn't get a picture of it. There's another one further up there. There's a bench. And even from quite far away, you can see that bench. And it helps. Of course it helps. There's a lovely view, but you can sit and look at the view from that bench. It's so welcome. The revealed glory of Jesus brought strengthening in the moment. In that moment, on the road of suffering, to the cross, it brought strengthening, but also gave confirming hope of glory to come. The present way of the cross, Christians, that we walk, that we're called to walk, is a narrow path. It's hard, and few find it. So to keep going, we need strengthening today, which of course acts to strengthen us today, but also to lift our eyes to see the glory to come is real. That is why we can keep going. There is a glorious rest at the end. The cost of the cross seems lighter when the crown is in sight. What's a crown? Right at the back of the church. And we see that losing our lives now really is worth it. When we get a glimpse that future glory is real. It's real. So today, God willing, we will experience the transforming power of Jesus' transformation. Firstly, Jesus was transformed. Glory is seen. Peter, James and John have had 6 days to chew over this call of dying, taking up the cross. And now as they ascend this high mountain, they must have been perhaps feeling a bit dead themselves, physically, puffing and panting and sharing the cereal bars, glugging water, moaning about the lack of mobile signal. But mountaineering can be pretty deadly, can't it? In this case, it's death defeating. God often used these elevated places. We see it in the Bible in a few places, don't we? To reveal himself. And now Peter, James and John are about to have their faith raised. They've just heard the cost. Now they're about to have their faith raised. Because there, away from everyone, something astonishing happens. Jesus' drab, travel-worn clothes become dazzlingly white. His whole appearance takes on another world kind of brilliance. A purity, as if he's clothed with light itself. The washing powder companies have calmed down a bit with adverts, I think. But they want us to believe that their products get our whites the whitest, don't they? They compete to tell us they're the best and so on. Whiter than anyone else in this world. But Jesus, being out of this world, wins. He becomes dazzlingly white, supernaturally so, with a white so brilliant, it's not of this world. That's what kind of has been said here. Intensely white, as no one on earth could bleach them. There's no product that can make your clothes. This is supernatural. And Jesus is transformed before their eyes. And they get a behind-the-scenes look, don't they? A peek at the glory and the brilliance of Jesus, of his majesty, his splendor, which normally hidden by flesh, is momentarily seen. We sung it at Christmas, they'll be veiled in flesh, the Godhead see. Hail. What does that mean? Hail him, incarnate deity. In this moment, the veil is lifted. His deity becomes visible. They're seeing what he's really like. But disciples, as the disciples stagger back, Jesus is joined by two twin peaks from the Old Testament. There's Moses, the lawgiver, the leader of the Exodus, and then there's Elijah, one of the prophets, the deliverer, deliverer of Israel. Both of these guys, of course, have got mountaintop experience, Sinai and the Ten Commandments, and then Mount Carmel, Elijah and the sacrifice challenge for the prophets of Baal. And they begin having this chat with Jesus on the mountain. And Peter, who can never be quiet for long, speaks again, doesn't he? And he says, "It's good we're here." It's like, killer line. And he says, "How about some accommodation? Maybe a tent each." To be fair, his suggestion isn't as silly as it may sound. He's not saying, "Yeah, let's just play Boy Scouts, let's go camping," and stuff like that. Because actually it's honouring to guests to make a shelter, to make a covering. But Mark tells us why he spoke, doesn't he? He tells us he blabbed it out because he didn't know what to say. Peter just, bleh. He didn't know what to say. How often does that happen to us? Imagine Peter telling Mark later, "Me and my big mouth again." One of those moments again. He said it because they were frightened. They see Jesus in his glory and are terrified. And the problem today is we don't see Jesus as jaw-droppingly kind of fall onto our knees awesome, do we? They didn't know what to say because they were terrified. What if there was a narration about our encounter with Jesus? What would it read our response was like? Perhaps our encounter with Jesus could be described as something like, they didn't know what to say because they were only mildly interested. They didn't know what to say because they were a bit bored, really. They didn't know what to say because they were kind of glad it was all over because they wanted lunch. Sorry. Why aren't we filled with awe at Jesus? Probably because we mostly see him as a kind of nice, helpful, middle class, slightly pale, unintimidating man. And because in our quiet times, again, perhaps we rarely meditate on passages like Exodus 19, Isaiah 6, Ezekiel 1, Daniel 10, Matthew 17, Mark 9, Revelation 1, Revelation 19. We need to fight to see behind the veil that Jesus is mind-blowingly great, unspeakably glorious and majestic, magnificent. The one we follow is full of splendor, far beyond what we can comprehend. Well, moments later, Peter's words are forgotten because a cloud overshadows the three on the mountain, and then this unforgettable voice speaks. And the cloud descending takes us back, doesn't it, to Exodus 19, back to Sinai, reminds us of the weightiness of God. Our God is too often kind of light and fluffy, kind of candy floss God, pink and nice. It's not the God of the Bible. He's heavy. He's awesome. He's full of splendor. And God the Father speaks, "This is my Son whom I love. Listen to him." And then suddenly as it's begun, it's all over. It's just them and Jesus the man in his dusty drab charity shop clothes. I think, what was all that about? What's going on there? Hope transformed. Glory to come. As they come down the mountain, Jesus, who was and is, of course, amazingly glorious, returns to the road of suffering, the road to the cross. And verse 9, he tells them, again, don't tell anyone about this. Well, for the first time, this. Don't tell them until I've risen. Why? Well, because they won't get it. They won't get him. Some will hear about it and they'll try and accelerate Jesus' death, but it's not time yet. Others will hear about this if they tell, and they'll try and make Jesus king. But it's not time for him to be king yet, and not in the way that they think. But when he has risen, as Jesus says, that's the time. Then they'll understand. First suffering, groan before glory. And that's the point of the Elijah exchange in verses 10 to 13. It's often said coming down the mountain is harder than going up. That's kind of true here as the disciples try and make sense of what Jesus is saying about rising are kind of chatting to each other. What does he mean? Rising from the dead? Is this kind of spiritual hidden meaning going on here? They discuss, and so they ask Jesus a question. Well, why must Elijah come first? And they ask that because, likely because of a verse in chapter 4, verse 5, that Elijah must come before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. A day mentioned in Daniel 12, verse 2, when all will rise, so there's Elijah, there's the rising, at the end of the age. I think their link between Jesus talking of rising and their Elijah question is the day of the Lord. When Elijah comes, all will rise. But they don't suppose that Elijah will literally come back, or rather they do, sorry. They suppose that he will literally come back, which is not the case, of course. But them thinking he will literally come back makes sense as well. Remember, there were two who didn't die in the Old Testament, weren't there? The first one, who didn't die in the Old Testament? Enoch. Yeah, he didn't die, did he? Perhaps it's just Enoch's his head. Sorry. And Elijah, the second one, was swept up in a chariot. So Jesus replies to them, yeah, you're right. Elijah comes first. But why then, here's a question back from Jesus, why then is it written, the Son of Man must suffer much and be rejected? Well, the answer is, Elijah has come back already. But don't have a triumphal view of him. Elijah's already come back. He has already suffered. He's already died. And in the Matthew 17 account, it says they realized that Jesus was talking about John the Baptist, the new Elijah type, the type of Elijah, prophet like Elijah. Remember chapter 1 of Mark, camel hair, leather belt in the desert. Look, this is the new Elijah. This is the Elijah prophesied to come, the second Elijah, if you like. And what Jesus is doing here is drawing parallels between Elijah and John the Baptist and himself and Elijah. So there's this kind of triangle, interrelated triangle of comparisons. Jesus will suffer as was written of Elijah. John suffered like Elijah. Jesus will suffer like John. Now, if you're lost somewhere on the mountainside, don't worry. Let's get back on track. Jesus wants them to see that for the new Elijah, John the Baptist, and for himself, here's the point, suffering comes first. Suffering comes first. As it is written, so it must be fulfilled. Expect suffering. That's the point. But, back to verse 9, also a rising. A rising. Now, how does a rising transform our hope? Well, let's just park ourselves up on that hillside bench for a moment. We'll take stock. And we see a kind of little pattern here. Hope you can see it all right. So we've got glory seen for them, the transfiguration. They just witnessed it. Suffering in the present. They're back on the road of suffering to the cross. Glory to come. A resurrection is coming. Jesus has just told them that. And the disciples need to remember this glimpse of glory. They need it to stick. Because as they walk the road to the cross in the present, as they see him die, as they see him go in the tomb, they need to remember who he really is. He's glorious. And they therefore need to be strengthened to wait, to hang in there for the resurrection to come. So that's true for the disciples. That's what happened. We two need to see the glory of Jesus. Today, we think of the transfiguration. We remember his resurrection. That needs to stick in us now, all the time, doesn't it? As we walk the narrow path, as we take up our cross, as we deny ourselves, we need to remember tomorrow, Wednesday, whatever, when it kicks in, when life gets hard, when self-sacrifice looks like a really silly thing to do. We need to remember how glorious Jesus is, so that our hope is transformed from a distracted, kind of half-baked Christianity at times to hope-filled. Because, last one over there, he will return, glory to come. He will return on the clouds in glory. He will raise his people to take them to be with him. Father says, listen to my son. The son says to us that he'll be with us to the end of the age and that he will return in glory and he will raise us up to be like him. So this week, when you're feeling like giving up at times, when we fear what people think of us, when we're tempted to sin, when we don't want to deny ourselves, remember who Jesus really is. He's glorious, and glory is to come. And we need this glimpse of Jesus to transform our hope, to transform our devotion to him. That's why we had verses 14 to 27 read to us, because in this passage we see his resurrection power. In verse 14, they kind of come back down to earth with a bump, don't they, to this distressing scene of humanity struggling in sin, demon possession. But in verse 25, when Jesus delivers this young man, Mark's use of language is quite striking. I'll put the verse on the screen, because in the ESV, it helps us a little bit. This is the ESV version. I'll read it to us. I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. And after crying out, he convulsed him terribly. That is the demons. It came out and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, he's dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up and he arose. It's really interesting, isn't it? Mark describes an exorcism as if it were a resurrection. But the main emphasis in this little section here really is on believing. The disciples are rebuked, aren't they, for their lack of faith. And who's our model in this little passage? Verse 24. What a line. What a line to have in God's word. He says, doesn't he? I believe. I do believe. I help my unbelief. Faith is what we need. Strengthening of our belief is what we need, isn't it? For hope to be transformed. What we see, but we need to see much more. Because belief is the difference between us kind of meandering through this life, unsure, lacking hope, between following half-heartedly and following wholeheartedly, between seeing self-denial as a kind of a burden, really, rather than a road to glory, between seeing prayer as a chore rather than a glorious opportunity to seek God's face. It's unbelief that makes us put our trust in ourselves, isn't it? It's unbelief that will mean we give Jesus like one day a week and the rest, we govern. Maybe your first love for Jesus has gone cold. Maybe you look inside and actually you see a very iffy looking follower of Jesus. Maybe you know you're very lethargic as a Christian, distracted, kind of only slightly interested. What do you need? Or perhaps you've fallen for believing that this world offers more than Jesus. What do you need? Or perhaps you've never known what it means to take up your cross and follow Jesus for the first time. Or what do you need? Or for the hard truth of suffering and self-sacrifice, the disciples needed this glimpse of glory, didn't they? This transforming vision of sight of Jesus, and so do we. The lies of the devil, the deceit of our own hearts, means we need to behold his glory and keep beholding his glory, don't we? We become what we behold. So let me encourage us all, encourage myself, we seek him. Seek him in worship. In John chapter 17, Jesus prays that his people will see his glory. His desire for us Christians is that the veil be drawn aside so that we see him, so the veil is lifted from our hearts, and that we believe. We believe, but we are helped in our unbelief. Let's worship and let's be ready. The glorious risen Lord is coming back. How do we want him to find us when he returns? That's a sharp question, isn't it? Wouldn't it be awful to be found not ready when he comes back? And we don't know when he's coming back. May all our relationships be honouring. May our priorities, our doings, our God glorifying, everything be honouring to him. May we be found on the narrow path, on the road of suffering, self-sacrifice, self-denial. And so let's endure hardship. Let's get the perspective right. Jesus isn't saying nice life now, but he says in my Father's house, there's many, many rooms. Stay on that road, wait. In my Father's house are many rooms. Glory is not now. So let's not be deceived. Let's not waste precious time chasing earthly glory, comforts and riches. They are light, they're pathetic in comparison to the eternal weight of glory to come. Accept no fake versions of glory. And let's also, lastly, expect transformation in ourselves. The goal is growth. The goal is we persevere, isn't it? Now, we all, without exception, underestimate the glory of Jesus. We need to see better, don't we? See the man. See the plan. Hear the call. And follow. And see the glory to come. And as we do, he transforms his people from one degree of glory to another. His glory changes us. So let's pursue him. Let us deny ourselves. Take up our cross. Why? Because future glory is real. We've got a couple of things on the back of the notice sheet. And we encourage you again to learn a verse. I've put two on there. It should say Mark 9 verse 3. But if you want to learn a verse, choose whichever one jumps out at you. Verse 24 is a good verse to learn as well. Prayer to pray. Songs to sing. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. There's a great song to start your day. Look on his wonderful face. And look at that problem. And look at that person. And look at that job. Look at his wonderful face. Get the perspective right at the beginning of each day. Another great song from the Inside Out Hillsong. It's a very, very helpful song in many ways. And then there's three questions to chew over in your own time alone with the Lord. Maybe as a couple, maybe as a family. What struck you? Anything struck you? What are you going to do? It's easy, isn't it? Hear something, just walk away. We do it all the time. Speak for myself. What are we going to do? And we're looking out. Who can we share? Who can we share the glory of Christ with? Is he worth sharing? Who can we pray about? How can we try and get alongside people?